Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban.
Coming to you from the center of the cannabis universe, that is Suite 420 here in the historic Equitable Building in downtown Denver, Colorado. This is the Hoban Minute. Today we're talking about where the puck is going, and we are joined by founding partner and chief investment officer of Clientele Capital Management Group, Rick Badenberg III. Rick, thank you for being with us here on the Hoban Minute.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be a guest.
No, we're super thrilled to have you on. And before we get into Clientele, give us a little bit of background about what you were doing before the cannabis industry and before you started this venture capital firm.
Sure. So I was a Merrill Lynch private wealth guy, specializing in bringing alternatives into our portfolio after college for about 3.5 years. We also ran the syndicate and the IPO desk, so meaning we were executing, doing the buys of those secondaries and IPOs as they would come up and putting them in our portfolio. So I learned really how to do the business from Merrill Lynch. And then about after 3.5 years, left there in 2015, and my father and I created a venture capital firm with the specific focus on allocating into cannabis because we're really in a capital restrictive environment, and saw an opportunity to put capital into the hands of entrepreneurs that we thought had some opportunities and ideas that just needed a little bit of help and infrastructure.
Well, that's awesome, man, and thank you for giving us that background. But let's talk a little bit about the current market situation in cannabis. And I know that your firm has been incredibly successful in the past couple of years. And give us a little bit about the secret sauce of what goes into that and understanding the macroeconomics of the cannabis market as it stands today.
Sure. You know, to understand the cannabis market, you really have to evaluate each state and every regulatory environment individually, because they have their own little nuances that really can affect the way that you do business there. And so really, when you are evaluating a cannabis investment, it's very important to understand the context in which that you are involving yourself in the supply chain and how that supply chain is affected by the regulatory environment. Let me give you an example I'm talking about. So the THC products cannot be moved over state lines, right? So they need to be created, marketed, sold, and consumed in the same state. Now, because of this, it creates a difficulty to go to scale, meaning you can't create and sell products over state lines and centrally manufacture them. And so that creates a little bit of an issue when you're trying to scale a business, right? Because that's what produces revenue, is your ability to scale products. Is really about, you've got amount of fixed costs, meaning you've got, you know, your CEO, your CFO, you've got your call it operational group, right? Your management team, which is what we consider a fixed cost. But you really have to recreate that in each individual state where you can't move THC over state lines because of the regulatory environment in the United States. So that presents a really big challenge for companies that are trying to, for example, a brand that's trying to sell their products into multi-state. So what that means is that if we're evaluating a company that is trying to create a brand, you better hope that or due diligence and make sure that they have a strategy for overcoming, you know, that particular issue. Same thing if you're evaluating something in supply chain like a dispensary, you better understand that there are tax implications that disallow you from writing off your rent and your labor expense against your cost of goods, and that those two items are going to be your biggest expenses that all of a sudden you have margin compression because you can't write down those expenses, and all of a sudden 280E, which is a tax code that affects cannabis businesses, really creates a challenging environment for dispensaries that maybe if an extraction facility doesn't have those same challenges because of the regulatory environment and the tax code. And so what this really boils down to is that because we are in a very tumultuous and changing regulatory environment, what has made us successful, the secret sauce, as you refer to it, is really about understanding the numbers of what you're getting involved in. And so there's three things that we always look for in investment. And number one is that the CEO can do everyone's job in the company, right? So meaning they understand their business from a hands-on perspective. They really can put all of the pieces together. The number two thing is that the CEO would rather die than fail, right? So the leadership group is extraordinarily passionate and personally invested into the success or failure of that company. And then the number three thing that we look for, and this is what I'm talking about, is understanding your numbers. You really have to dial in understanding how you make money, where your gross margins are, where your net margins are. You really have to understand what your costs are and evaluating that, because there's a big misconception in cannabis in general that everybody's making money hand over fist, and that's simply not true, as I'm sure you guys know. And so what that created was a bubble. So from a macroeconomic perspective, you have all these companies that went public, and there was all of this hysteria, right? After about November 2018, when the Farm Bill Act crop passed, there's all this hysteria. So there was a lot of private investors, retail investors, that were dumping money into these cannabis companies, assuming these companies are making money because of all those assumptions that people made. You're like, oh, you're selling weed, you guys must be making money. Which is simply not true. You know, you're in one of the most highly regulated environments in the world, and you're in an illegal space, which is preventing you from doing banking, right? You also have challenges against scaling, which means that it's much harder to create margin, right? We're able to create margin, and the scale is what makes the money, right? So if you're only making 10% and you sell $10 worth of things, costs you $9, you've made $1. The trick to that is you can make 10%, but you need to sell 1 million things, right? And so if you have to stay within the confines of your state, okay, well, now we have a limited amount of market, accessible market, which means that, A, it's more difficult to make money because you've got a limited environment, but it's also more difficult to exit the business because there's a finite amount of growth that you can have, right? So these are all just macroeconomic challenges that are presented by the regulatory environment in the United States. So what that means is that when you're looking at a cannabis investment, you really want to understand, can they produce EBITDA with their accessible market, right? And are they capable of expanding beyond, you know, their current market allocations? And what is the cost of expanding outside of that? Because really, you have to recreate the same infrastructure in each of these markets, which is incredibly expensive. And you watched a lot of these large publicly traded firms who did basically what we call as a land grab, right? They went out, they're like buying everything because they were overfunded, right? So what ended up happening was they didn't have the infrastructure in place to manage that growth, right? They didn't have the on-the-ground experience to actually manage all those businesses. So we're seeing this retraction now where they're selling off assets and trying to focus on EBITDA, which has been a big bubble pops at the top, right? And now everyone's selling off assets because they were not able to turn balance sheet items, meaning they bought grows and they bought extractions, they bought, you know, all these different assets, but they weren't able to monetize them because they didn't have the infrastructure or the acumen to actually manage and roll out those assets because, like all things, it takes THC, right? It takes time, love, and attention, not just a big bag of money. So I guess the overall look at this is like, if you're going to invest in public companies, you really want to take a look at their balance sheet, make sure that they're not overweight on their balance sheet and they're servicing a bunch of debt. That's going to ultimately affect their EBITDA, right? That's going to affect their net. And then also you want to look for companies that have an emotional relationship with their consumer and distribution, meaning are they solving a specific problem for a specific group that knows who they are? And so those type of, you know, general investing principles applied to cannabis are going to keep you out of trouble, right? So if you're looking at like, okay, well, they have a good product, people know their product, they know they have good distribution, and they're not so far overweight in their ability to produce that product that they're able to scale up relative to their available market size, their sure. available customer base.
Well, you know, you said a couple things that I think are very interesting, and that is the idea of recreating the infrastructure for a business and the marijuana side of the industry, jurisdiction by jurisdiction, sure. And the fact that this mm-hmm. is intrastate. Now, I've always argued that that fact is actually what keeps the industry here and keeps public policymakers' attention, because inefficiency in production equates to more jobs when you have to recreate an industry. The rudimentary way I always explain it is if efficiencies were allowed and interstate commerce were allowed in this industry, you'd see, you know, the entire state of Nebraska growing cannabis and there'd be distribution outlets across the coasts. That's an exaggeration to illustrate a point. But because you can't have that, you have to replicate that state by state by state, which exponentially increases the number of jobs, but it doesn't provide for the business efficiencies that you describe. So it is absolutely something to be cognizant of. And you're focused on evaluation at looking at leadership. We've seen so many quote-unquote CEOs in this space who were perhaps not only not qualified to be in that position, but that couldn't understand or complete tasks that were relevant to different elements of the business. Now, the title of this episode is Where the Puck is Going, and that's an analogy. Another thing I like to refer to a lot, and I always think about, I grew up outside of Philadelphia, and I was a Philadelphia Flyers fan growing up, and there was a big defenseman, a Swede named Shel Samuelson. He was 6'6", 6'8". He was so slow. But if you got in front of you, you couldn't see past him, and he was a bruiser. Now, it's where the puck is going. If he skated to where the puck was, he'd never get there. Nobody would really get there. You have to know where the puck is going. So what's the wisdom of clientele right now? You described how you evaluate deals. Bringing this thing back sure. to strategy, what do you see as yeah. some of the hot spots? We talk about international. We talk about hemp, but beyond CBD. We talk about aggregation of these quote-unquote essential businesses across the country when we talk about marijuana businesses. What's your strategy? Where do you see the puck going?
So, you know, I think Gretzky would be so proud of you. And actually, it's hilarious that quote, exact quote, has been etched on a crystal cube that sits on my father's desk and has since I was a kid. And you're absolutely correct. And it's described a lot of different ways. You know, venture guys like to describe this being around corners, but really it's about understanding where the market is going so that you can organize your strategy to access that market, right? So it really is relativistic to your time horizon, right? So I could pontificate on when we think that we're going to have ubiquitous legalization in the United States, but because taxes are collected at the dispensary level, I think it's very unlikely that even with ubiquitous legalization that it's going to affect some of the companies quite as dramatically as everyone assumes, because the states are going to continue to regulate cannabis because it's a controlled substance and they have the infrastructure to do so. So I think it's much more likely that the feds are going to get out of the way of the regulation of cannabis in lieu of trying to regulate it themselves. So that's, I guess, from a perspective of, I talked a lot about the regulations and how those can affect your future plans. And the reason that I wanted to address that is because you're absolutely correct in the way that with ubiquitous legalization, it totally makes more sense that we'd be growing hemp out in Nebraska, even THC. So you're absolutely correct. And what I would submit is that because the money is what is driving a lot of the politicians to give this the check off, especially more right-leaning states, the way that this is taxed is going to prohibit the kind of free-for-all federal legalization that everyone's kind of anticipating at some point, right? So what I would submit to you is that's less important than everybody thinks. It's definitely going to change some things, but really it's about the consumer. And you had referred to something earlier, which was maybe those CEOs are not, qualified to be in that role. And it's not necessarily that they weren't qualified to be a CEO. It's that what they discounted was the role of the consumer, right? And the legacy of that consumer's ability to choose, right? So they had come at this with a very sterile financial approach to the cannabis market. And that was for one reason, which is Canada went ubiquitously legal before us, and they had real big banks that were able to bank their deals. Okay. So the United States has not been able to think about this, right? Bank America, all of JP Morgan, all of the big real investment banks have not touched cannabis in the United States at all. Okay. That is the one big shift that's going to happen when cannabis is allowed to bank. You are going to see a monster shift in the way that large CPG companies like Coca-Cola, P&G, those companies have not even scratched the surface. They have not even gotten involved in cannabis because comparatively, okay, to the other markets, and I'm not talking cannabis, I'm talking, you know, just consumable goods, right? Cannabis is still a very small component of that comparatively to the revenue of those other companies who have not gotten involved. Now, the reason they haven't gotten involved is because of the banking problem and not like, hey, I need a checking account. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is an investment bank's ability to take investments from all of their clients, right, across the United States, and then invest it into a really big corporate cannabis deal. Okay, that has not happened yet. That is going to be the big shift. Now, Canada, okay, all of those Canadian companies, because they didn't do it state to state or province to province like we did in the United States, Canada turned on ubiquitous legalization, which has instantly turned all of these bankers who are in control of the money into creating these SPACs, right, special purpose acquisition vehicles, raising a bunch of money into it, and then putting a board together of all of these bankers. And guess what? The bankers didn't understand, right? They tried to have a very sterile land grab approach to create a supply chain in the United States, but they had completely forgotten that's really referring to is their lack of qualification was not necessarily that they didn't know how to run a company. Of course they did, right? These are really seasoned executives, CEOs, people that understand how to develop a supply chain and deliver products and sell products. And what they didn't understand was the legacy of the cannabis plant in general and how important that is to not only people who consume the plant, but really the industry people, right, who are there on the ground every day, the bud tenders who are talking and recommending these products. They did not have the respect and still don't have the respect of the bud tenders, of the industry, of the buyers, which ultimately is what was their demise, or not demise, but it was what the challenge was, and that was what they failed to see. Now, we have not had that same problem, and just as you very aptly described, creating jobs, right? Because and I can tell you that my firm would never have had a shot if the United States went ubiquitous illegal, right? But I was able to kind of grow up with Colorado, right? It gave us an opportunity to scale and become bigger, right? Because there was not all these big companies coming in and creating this level of competition that we just simply couldn't compete with. So the United States is in a little bit of a different scenario where you've got these companies that have kind of become bigger, right, in their state or their respective states, which creates a little bit of a different environment when we talk about moving things internationally. There are brands in these smaller, in these states that consumers are extraordinarily familiar with and that they trust. But as we mentioned earlier, moving those brands into a new state is tremendously expensive, right? It's very difficult to recreate that infrastructure. And every regulatory environment is different, which means that those little companies either need to find private money, okay, or they have to borrow money, but they can't go to their local bank and go, hey, I want a loan to expand, okay? Now, that inefficiency is specifically why I left Merrill Lynch, because I would figure out, oh, we have an extraordinarily inefficient capital market, which means that with very little capital relative to, you know, JP Morgan or Merrill Lynch, I can make a very large impact, right? Because we've got huge barriers to entry, not only in regulatory environments, but also because, you know, there's a finite amount of supply chain in the Canada space.
Your description of the quote unquote demise, which again, I think we both agreed, like, as you mentioned a minute ago, is not exactly accurate, but the string of failures across many of these Canadian corporations, and their leadership. I agree with the way, and I like the way you described it, and that's really, really telling. The way I always thought of it, which is the same thing, it's just saying another way, is the Canadian companies came in and stacked their ranks with pedigreed professionals, executives, people from ag, people from finance. And these people, by all accounts, had great experience, great education, and could thrive in an environment as such. But they did not understand the industry. They certainly didn't understand the consumer. But you can't just go out and hire a botanist and figure out that a botanist is somehow going to put together a formula that in turn creates a successful facility that consistently produces material. You have to start with people within the industry and the expertise and the knowledge, and then perfect and refine that. So, we're living and learning at the same time here. Another thing that I think is interesting is, I think you're right. I think the federal government is not going to actively regulate it. I recently wrote an article in Forbes that addressed that exact topic to say it's not going to come out and we don't want it to come out and create a new excise division within, ATF or something along those lines that regulates this plan. They want to get out of the way. They want to leave it to the states. It is akin to the alcohol model in the sense that, most alcohol is regulated at the states and it's overseen by a division within the federal government. But we don't want it to come in and get its hands in the active regulation, and nor does it want to. So that does provide a pathway, but I also don't think, given our political landscape and the fact that as Americans we seem more comfortable continuing to do the thing we want to do and making subtle modifications around the edges from a policy standpoint versus addressing the issue head on.
And what's interesting is that I have a senator buddy that he writes a lot of the blue sky laws, a lot of the guidance for Colorado State, and he said something significant to me that always kind of stuck with me. But he said that nothing unites Democrats and Republicans quite like hating Washington, and it really hadn't occurred to me because in my sensibilities are always like, oh, it's like Democrat Republican, and these two groups are at war with each other. But when he said that to me, and this was probably a couple years ago, it really clicked to me. I was like, wow, you know what? Like in Colorado, the legislature gets a lot of things done between the Democrats and the Republicans. And nothing unites them quite like telling Washington to pound sand, right? It's very much like, stay out of our business. Like, we got it. We don't need you to tell us how to run our state. From an upward pressure. We're talking very sophomorically, so I'm not trying to take a political position as much as understand that all these are really human beings, right? They're Colorado residents, they're whatever residents, and they are not as concerned about the political lines as they are about having control over their own space. Does that make sense? They don't want guidance from the feds. They don't need the federal government in their stuff. They don't want that, whether they're Republican or Democrat. They don't want to be told what to do, which is exactly what you're referring to, which is part of the other reason that I think that even with ubiquitous legalization, the states are still going to have an overlay of their own regulation, which is going to ultimately limit interstate trade and maintain some of the infrastructure that's been built in all these different states.
And I think because of that, it will create creative economic opportunities I don't mean progressive in a political sense. I mean forward-looking governors that look out and say, hey, we're the state of Colorado. Maybe we enter into a compact with New Mexico and another state that's adjacent.
Well, potentially, but okay, so here's the issue, though, is that when two state residents, and I'm sure as you as the Hoban Group know, two state residents of different states, if there is a discrepancy, right, and they sue each other, that has to be overseen by the federal government, which creates violates the Interstate Trade Commerce Act, which is why it's going to be a problem, right? So if the feds aren't regulating it, right, and they have to oversee a marijuana case, there's a problem, right? So that is going to that is the main reason that we cannot move over state to state, is because the feds cannot oversee a case that is technically illegal, right? So regardless of whether the states get along is irrelevant, right? If there was a discrepancy or a dispute, the feds couldn't oversee it. So they're not going to allow, regardless of what the states want to do, they're not going to allow interstate trade until the laws of the federal level change.
Well, certainly federal legal processes in the court system at that level are extraordinarily complex, and you make a ton of good points. But also keeping up with our theme, let's talk about your venture in Breckenridge. I understand that you've got an investment and you've got a something that you're very proud of, which is very exciting, and that involves a independent hockey team. And let's talk a little bit about that. And for as I recall traveling back and forth to the airport years ago, and I haven't seen this in a couple of years, there was a team out of the Denver Coliseum called the Denver Cutthroats. I don't know if it's, akin to that, but it is something that I recall. I've never been to a game, but tell us a little bit about it. That sounds like a really, really exciting thing you're working on.
Sure. You know, so, you know, I started the team about 7 years ago when I was still working at Merrill Lynch, and it was really a product of, you know, I think that there's something honorable about trying to beat a team that's doing everything they can to beat you, and the kind of rec league that I was playing in wasn't really getting it done. So after college, I was either go play pro in Europe or go work for Merrill Lynch. And I sold my soul and went to work for Merrill Lynch, but I found myself, unfulfilled. Being the kind of, jump and figure it out on the way down kind of person, I started buying ice and marketing a pro hockey team, a semi-pro team, and then booking exhibition games against teams across the West. So we play in the Mountain West Division or Mountain West League, which is a semi-pro league from California. So San Diego, Vegas, all the way up to Bozeman and Sun Valley, Vail, Breckenridge, San Diego, Houston. And we started playing games. So I was laughing with your co-host there earlier, but always described myself as the Jackie Moon of hockey because we've been up there for about 6 years now, and I have a lot of fun. It's a good league full of a lot of ex pro players, Div 1 hockey players. It's full of a lot of really good hockey players, and it's a lot of fun. We sell out those games up in Breckenridge, and it's a riot. But it's really about there's something honorable in doing everything you can to beat a team that's doing everything they can to beat you. And frankly, I never had so much fun playing hockey as I did, as I do playing for the Vipers. But, it's definitely been a journey. One of the most fulfilling things that I've ever done is creating that up there. So it's definitely been, one of the most meaningful things that I've been able to do as a hockey player and as a venture capital guy, because that team hopefully will be up there for a very long time and, give guys an opportunity to play at a level that they wouldn't have otherwise been able to play and, give the people of Breckenridge something to do on Friday and Saturday nights other than go to the same bar and drink the same beer. So cheap beer and hockey fights always seems to attract the right people. So
that's very special, Rick, and we thank you for sharing that. And we'll have another discussion in the future around professional sports and cannabis. We've been in this sports purgatory for so long, and now with a couple things coming back, like the NBA, we're certainly excited about it. And there's
and Eric, as I told you, we watched the Nuggets preseason game on television today. That's how excited we were.
It's
right.
It's all coming. Hopefully, fingers crossed, knock on wood. Rick, thank you so much for being here with us today. If you want to learn more about Clientele Capital, go to clientelecapital.com. And as Rick, as you said earlier, you give everybody 15 minutes for a pitch. So anybody out there who thinks that they have a great idea, feel free to go to Rick and give it your best shot. Thank you for coming on the Hoban Minute, man, and we'll talk to you soon.
Hey, thank you guys so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. And if there's anything else I can do, please don't hesitate to reach out.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.